Welcome to Dithering on the Edge of Europe, the podcast about what it feels like to be living in the UK and on the edge of Europe, the climate catastrophe, epidemics, pandemics, and everything else. Today, as usual, it's me, Rich McCarthy, ex-teacher, ex-energy auditor, and dad and house husband. With me is...
Carola Boom, European, German, wife, mother, academic, and living here in the UK as well.
Okay.
So, we, as announced, the whole season, we're going to focus on different types of Green New Deals. We mentioned that we wanted to understand the good, the bad, and the ugly. There might be some cheap and cheerful nasty deals.
Maybe, yeah.
Green New Deals out there. There might be some fluffy, woolly, nice Green New Deals.
If they're fluffy and everything and also lovely and nice, then I think they probably wouldn't work. But
right, okay. But today...
They need to be hard and tough, Green New Deals.
But today we'll deal with the Green Party of England and Wales, Green New Deal. Mm-hmm. And I've just come across this article just recently by Colin Hind, who, of course, was one of the founding members of the Green New Deal group. He wrote an article, The Green Bridge, from tackling coronavirus to tackling climate change. And of course, you know, that's what we've also said in the last episode. We have to actually move out of lockdown into a new green economy. How do we do that? Well, we're going to look at one Green New Deal today because there are a lot of solutions in there.
But clearly that's something that people should have a look at perhaps because he's thinking of it not from a perfect perspective, but he's just saying, well, from the messy start that we've got right now, how do we go from here?
You know, as we said before, Green New Deals are job creation machines.
You're laughing. I'm laughing. You just can't help but steal the quote from something or other
yes.
that you've yourself got lined up for later on.
Naomi Klein.
Yes, go ahead.
No. It's Naomi Klein, On Fire. She wrote a book last year, which was called On Fire. And she's got some really, really fabulous quotes in there. And one of them is, the Green New Deal is a job machine. And it's recession-proof.
Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons for that is in the we've got the objectives of the Green New Deal group in their preface to the Green New Deal bill were that number one was that it was immediately going to try and tackle the climate emergency. Secondly, that they would aim for net zero emissions, CO2 emissions by 2030. Thirdly, that it recognises that the biodiversity crisis at the same time, because without recognising that, then what's the point of doing all this? And fourthly, it recognises the inequality crisis as well at the same time as the climate crisis. And all of their promoted policies within the bill must address inequality. And it's that addressing inequality which makes the Green New Deal recession-proof, because if there is a recession and work starts going away... Then it isn't that some people go out of work and become desperately poor. It's that everybody works less. And we're all a little bit poorer, but we'd all have a bit more time. So that would be a good thing as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Poorer, but richer at the same time.
And of course, you know, these four objectives by the Green New Deal group, they point towards something that our mainstream hasn't really grasped yet. And again, I quote Naomi Klein from her book. You know, she says, every part of the world that has invested heavily in renewables and efficiency has found these sectors to be much more powerful job creators than fossil fuels. So even if you deny that we're at the brink of extinction, you know, it makes economic sense to go towards a green economy.
So this is the Green Party's Green New Deal, the English and Welsh Green Party's Green New Deal from the election 2019, last year.
From their manifesto.
From their manifesto, yes.
And we'll put the links into the show notes as well.
That's super, yeah. We'll do that. And so basically they split their Green New Deal into six parts. And we have to say that we're probably not going to get through this all in one episode. We would like to, but A, we're not going to be able to, really. And B... It's the sort of topic that you need to come back to three or four times. You can't get it all in one go. So
Or just listen to our podcasts repeatedly.
Yes, but we can't convey everything. If we read it out, it would take longer than 30 minutes or an hour, I think.
Right, but it has six parts.
But it had six parts, which I said, but I didn't say what the parts were, did I? Do you want to tell us what the parts are?
Yeah, so energy, housing, transport. Then it has industry, and it's actually interesting because I would have used the term economy, but it's probably intentional that they used industry as a term, you know, mm-hmm. given the discussion that we just had about economic growth.
But I think industry also means, you know, industry, making stuff, manufacturing.
Yeah. Then the fifth pillar is forestry and farming, and the last pillar is income. So energy, housing, transport, industry, forestry and farming, and income.
Okay, so if we look at energy first of all, so the first thing is that the domestic renewable energy, and so the Green Party is saying that they would aim at providing 70% of the UK's electricity supply by renewables by 2030.
And just as a sort of comparison, the current government has announced that by 2030, their goal was around 30 to 35%, wasn't it?
Yeah, they sort of opened up marine wind energy. The industry is quite happy to go for making and producing the turbines and setting them up to produce 30 to 35% of our electricity by 2030.
Hmm.
And that's counted as being a fantastic leap. It's a big jump that's happening, being pushed by the private sector, by the government allowing the private sector to go for it. And it's costing very little. You know, it's the cheapest form of electricity that we're getting.
And of course, we're a country where we have a lot of seashore. We should actually be able to create a lot of wind electricity.
Yeah, hugely. And there's a lot of consideration for bird life. But I think in something like 14,000 hours of video of a wind turbine area, they recorded only six collisions of birds with the wind turbines in the 14,000 hours. You know, over the span of about several months anyway. I can't remember the time.
And so now we're using about 15% wind-generated electricity. We could, on good days, make a quarter of our electricity by wind already. So actually, you know, when you then think about it, the government goal of 30% is just nothing. Whereas actually we could create so much more energy by wind.
Well, that 30 to 35% is not on a day. That would be generally
the year. It's compared to our 15% at the moment. That's the average. So we're using 15% right. energy. So that's 70% of our electricity. And then, of course, again, in the Green New Deal, we don't want to use any carbon-based energy sources like coal. There's, of course, other renewable energy sources, solar, geothermal, tidal, hydro.
Yeah.
And they can make up the last 30%.
Yes. And the big reason that we want things like, in particular, tidal and hydro is because those would be going on all the time. So there are apparently occasions when we might have a week of no wind, which would mean, since most of our renewable electricity comes from wind turbines, that would mean that we would suddenly, our electricity generation would go right down. So it's important that we also expand our research into wave power and tide power.
You know, we can create between 70% wind power and 30% solar, geothermal, tidal and hydro. We should be able to get 100% of our energy needs by 2030.
Hopefully, but the electricity needs will be much greater by 2030.
Right.
So we'll need a lot more electricity. At the moment, electricity is only about 25% of our energy usage. So we don't use electricity for transport, for example, which by 2030, we'd be hoping that most of our transport would be electrically powered.
Right.
We don't heat our homes with electricity at the moment. And by 2030, we'd be wanting to heat our homes with electricity. So electricity need or requirement is going to go up.
Yeah, okay.
In a big way.
And that then means the planning system has to be transformed to create that incentive and the regulatory frameworks that we will be able to achieve that.
There are things like, at the moment, because of the Conservatives, you have to go through a great big planning debacle every time you want to put up a wind turbine on land. It's not the same quite at the sea, but there's also a lot of Crown-owned a lot of the seashore is owned by the Crown, which means that you can't then just put up wind turbines there very easily. I think the Crown wouldn't be very much against us putting up turbines on their land, but that sort of thing would be addressed to make it easier to do.
And, you know, we are aware that there are communities who do not like to see the landscape riddled with, you know, windmills. I actually like them, I have to say. And it's just something that we have to accept. You know, we've accepted roads on our motorways in our landscape. We have to accept those. But I just want to highlight the fact that, you know, go back 300 years and the landscape was riddled with, you know, the old style windmills. And at that time, they probably didn't think of them as beautiful. Now we just think they're so utterly beautiful.
That's true, yeah.
You know, so is there a way, you know, where we paint them with gorgeous colors, with getting artists to paint them? Do we paint them blue so that they meld into the skyscape? You know, all sorts of things could be possible there. Let's start to love them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I, strangely enough, I find that I love seeing them on land. I don't like seeing them in the sea. But we get so much more energy from the sea-based ones because they get much more wind.
Yeah.
And so, obviously, I'm very happy to have them at the sea.
Right. Then, of course, what is also in the Green Deal in under the energy is carbon tax on imported energy.
Yeah, on anything. Basically, carbon tax would be applied to everything. So energy that's generated. Occasionally, we would be generating energy from gas. The Green Party would be assuming. So occasionally, on those becalmed periods, they would have to fire up a gas-fired power station, perhaps.
But it describes that also as a sort of incremental raising of the carbon tax to the point that by 2030, it's just commercially not viable to import non-sustainable energy.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's a good thing, but I'm not so sure about the incremental increase. I think it's a good idea to jump the increases because it gives the carbon people a lot of time to go and sell their carbon somewhere else, which isn't going to help the planet. So
I think the idea behind it is that to not make certain big parts of the economy unstable.
Yeah, you probably, yes, I'm sure that's correct.
No new nuclear power stations. That's, of course, in there. You know, Green Party as such has always been against nuclear power. And I think we don't have to spell it out. It's just something where the risk is too high. You know, it might be carbon neutral, but...
Well, it isn't carbon neutral.
Yeah, okay.
So
it's a distraction of creating a really sustainable green energy infrastructure. Then, of course, fracking is also something which is banned.
Fracking is awful.
Or should be banned.
And such a stupid thing to do.
And it's another form of...
Because it just poisons the water supply.
Fossil
it does all sorts of things.
Yeah,
and the biggest thing is that it leaves vast amounts of methane just leaking out of the ground. And methane, as we know, is 30 times as bad as carbon dioxide as a global climate warming gas. You know, at the moment, we've got huge amounts of methane leaking out of the North Sea, where we've had North Sea oil. And apparently the oil industry in Britain is much better regulated than the oil industry in America.
So that's the energy section. And as part of that, there's also training, behavioral change through regulation, energy efficiency training, and any kind of financial incentives. So, for instance, SMEs and co-ops would receive the training for free. That's part of this Green New Deal, so that the SMEs and co-ops can shift into the green economy without too much detriment to them.
Yeah, at the moment we've spoken. I suppose we'll come on to housing. There's a lot of the energy is linked to housing because of we've got to improve housing to cut the energy use of houses, for example.
So the next pillar is housing.
Yeah, okay, housing. And for me, you've got the top of your list as being 100,000 new homes for social rent. And they'd be assuming that 200,000 more homes built by private companies per year. Top of my list would be that all housing and all buildings would be
built
made
to passive house standards.
Well, they'd be built to those standards, but we're going to change existing housing so that existing housing is net zero as well.
Yeah, so retrofitting, is that the million existing homes, reduce heating bills by improving 1 million existing homes?
Yes, that's right, a year. So there are about 26 million homes. So 1 million homes a year, that's going to take 26 years to do. So obviously we can't get all that done by 2030, which was the the aim was to get to net zero by 2030, but by 2040, obviously, a lot more houses would be insulated.
Right.
And so it would be easier to be at net zero by 2040.
So there's a number, though, in the Green Party's Green New Deal, which says deep retrofitting of 10 million homes by 2030.
Yeah.
So how does that square with reduced heating bills by improving 1 million existing homes and building by year?
Well, it's because it's 10 years. So 1 million a year. I hope you keep that in. So good, we're all square on that. 1 million a year for 10 years makes 10 million.
Right, okay.
And that in itself is, you know, that's like a million jobs.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it's a big thing.
You know, there's a whole lot of apprenticeships needed for a green sort of economy that is based on a large retrofitting project.
Yeah. And that's why also part of the Green New Deal is that people would be trained, and they would not just would they be trained for free, but they would be, you know, they'd have some kind of an income while they're being trained.
Yeah. And it should be said that, again, in this Green New Deal, it spells out that the materials which will be used for insulation or for retrofitting should ideally be sustainable. You know, we've got sheep's wool in our walls, which, of course, when we started to research into it, when we renovated this house, we sort of realized how good sheep's wool actually is.
Yeah,
much
absolutely.
More better than any kind of synthetic stuff.
Yeah. And we were so fortunate in that the previous occupant of the house was also very green-minded, and she did a lot of insulation with slit sheep's wool and so on.
Yeah,
so that was fabulous.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it's a much, the house breathes much more, much better, and wool, as we now know, is much better at absorbing moisture from us in the house. So the walls can take in a little bit of moisture,
and then it gives off moisture,
and then put it out when it's bone dry inside. Then it'll give that moisture back out.
So it creates a very natural environment.
Yeah. Whereas the sort of more plasticky brand new housing tends to have a polythene backing to all of the plasterboard, which stops any moisture going through the plasterboard at all. So you can get very humid inside a new house much more easily than you can for us.
And
in
I think,
house.
You know, I do remember when we went in here, because the living room was still affected by a flooded cellar, which had happened a year before, and there was a lot of moisture in the walls, and it was so good.
And a hole in the wall as well.
Yes, a hole in the wall
which
as well.
Soaked the inside of the wall.
Yes, but you know, you had the confidence to say, well, no, we're going to do this and that, and we're going to use reusable materials, and the paint will be breathable, and it will be okay. And actually, the builder said, well, actually, you know, you should treat it. He said, no, it's going to be fine. We're going to have underfloor heating, and then with the breathability, it's fine. And it's fine now. It's perfect. You know.
It was a bit sweaty for a few months while that wall was drying out, I think. But after that, it's been brilliant. It's been fantastic.
Yeah, fabulous. So it works. It's not only sustainable. You know, you don't only do it to save the world. You do it to have a fabulous, nice, good-feeling environment.
Yeah. And because of all the we did put in quite a bit of insulation when we moved in, and that meant that our underfloor heating, which the underfloor heating people said, you really think you
windows.
Could heat the house this way? We're not absolutely sure. And we were like, no, we think it'll be perfectly okay. And it was fine because of those big areas of insulation that we fitted on the walls.
Yeah, we should say we've got an old Victorian house. So that's, of course, you know, and when we talk about this, the British housing stock is not as set up as well as maybe, you know, for instance, the German housing stock, where there was always more care in terms of house building and the whole infrastructure. You know, the whole sector is different, where you take more care. Each sort of element in that chain of building houses, you know, tends to have much more incentive to build much more sustainable. Whereas we haven't, but we also have a large old housing stock, Victorian houses and stuff like that, which are quite difficult to insulate, because they're being built to be leaky. You know, the floorboards, and underneath the floorboards quite often is just plain earth, you know. But the positive side of that is that now, when we move into that kind of economy, there are a lot of jobs needed for that kind of retrofitting.
Absolutely. If you can get into that area, then you'll have a job for life completely.
Right. as with the energy sector, of course, also with the housing sector, you know, it has a whole section where it discusses how the planning system needs to be transformed and building regulations to allow all the things that we mentioned to happen, to allow also to give the incentives for private developments to use the passive house standard.
And also, not just with that, you need local authorities to be able to come around and check on buildings. So that's really gone hugely in the last 10 years. Yeah. And we need local authorities who have the number of people employed to be able to check and who are of the quality to be able to check, because unfortunately, quality of British building is very poor. And if the house doesn't come up to the mustard, then they say it doesn't come up to the mustard and it has to be corrected before they can move on.
And the sort of planning system needs to incentivize the use of existing buildings, renovating them, extending them, improving them, rather than building new buildings on green spaces or green fields. And, you know, that just has to stop. And also the reduction of the use of steel concrete and cladding and finishes, which all use carbon. So there needs to be an incentive in the regulatory framework that allows builders to be afforded to use sustainable materials.
Yeah, and steel and concrete, for example, by their very manufacture, actually them, the chemical reactions that make steel and the chemical reactions that make concrete produce CO2. So that is a problem. You know, there is a way of making low CO2 concrete, and I think there's a low CO2 steel as well. And particularly if you can reuse concrete and you can reuse steel, that's a lot less carbon dioxide, because they've already had that carbon dioxide produced when they were made the first time around.
Right. So that's housing. So we have energy and housing, transport. I know time is running away with us, so we're going to try to do transport quite quickly.
Okay, transport.
So we only have 5 minutes for transport.
Yep.
It's a big one, though.
Yeah, all of these areas are fairly big. So transport, as the note says there, £2.5 billion a year on new cycleways and footpaths built using sustainable materials such as wood chips and sawdust. And if you can imagine, that's, again, a huge number of jobs. And they're local jobs, that every local authority can have more people working on producing something that more people can use and everybody needs.
And I like how this, you know, the Green New Deal in the manifesto, it sort of suggests that it will bring in a new golden age of train, opening new rail connections, you know, ones that also would remove bottlenecks, increase rail freight.
Freight.
And
we don't want to increase rail freight.
Ah!
Sorry, ma'am, I didn't mean to hurry to it.
And of course, you know, we do have the budgets for that. If we just grab HS2 and we switch that funding to creating new rail connections and improving, you know, the railway system that we have.
HS2 is going to cost £107 billion. The £107 billion would pay for easily for 20 years of building cycle paths and footpaths. And we'd have masses of money left over.
Just stop expanding airports.
Airports are completely unnecessary because we should not be expanding airport transport, air freight. And COVID-19 has shown us that it's not necessarily a good thing to be flying everywhere all the time. Mm-hmm. And if we aren't flying everywhere all the time, then those companies that say they need to expand and this, that and the other all fail to exist. They all go under. So we see that this is a thing that is not sustainable at all. All that air transport is not sustainable.
Hmm.
So we should be getting rid of it.
And, you know, it makes the interesting point of how to deal with frequent flyers. You know, instead of having frequent flyer credits, have frequent flyer levies, because it quotes the statistics again that 15% of people are taking 70% of the flights.
And
so tackling the frequent flying would already reduce it substantially.
Yeah. And even then, only 20% of flights were necessary for business. So we're told that we have to be open for business as the UK. Well, it's still only 20% of the flights are for business. The rest are for people going on holiday. And we are a hugely connected country and people do need to fly to other parts of the world to see family, or people need to fly in to see them perhaps every now and then. But I think we should say you have an allocation of flights. You're allowed to have one flight a year perhaps. And you could save it up and have two flights in 1 year or something along those lines, or sell it to somebody else.
The COVID crisis has also allowed us or afforded us to understand that we could do things differently and online. So, of course, Thursday, as you know, I did the whole day. I went to Switzerland virtually as an external examiner at a higher education institution there. And the prior 3 years, I went there physically. But on Thursday and Wednesday, it all happened online. It's doable.
And you used less carbon than me going to the supermarket tomorrow when I go shopping. Because I'm going to drive the car there.
Oh, no.
It's a bit of a distance from here, and we're buying a lot of stuff for 2 weeks.
I did want to mention one of the things that I thought was quite interesting in there of what we do with car ownership, because it sort of suggests that we should understand the notion of shifting car ownership to car usership, so car sharing, so that each town, each village has a car sharing model. And of course, there could be electric cars as well.
Well, it would be in 2030.
In 2030, yeah.
They would electrify all railway lines. That's a big thing.
Mm-hmm.
Makes the trains a lot cleaner, the air quality a lot cleaner, and it also makes them run on time much better.
It suggests that we create government-owned rolling stock company which invests in a fleet of new electric trains.
Yeah. Ron, why pay
somebody else?
Private companies to do it for us, because
make them ourselves, create jobs.
It costs more that way. So, yes, it costs less if we do it.
And we have the skills.
Yeah,
absolutely. But that's transport. Those were the three first pillars of the England and Wales Green Party manifesto, their Green New Deal.
Mm-hmm.
And those three pillars were, of course, energy, housing and transport.
And we will cover the next three next week. So those are industry, food, forestry and farming, and income. And have a great week, and please go and look at the show notes and read up on them, because it's very rewarding.
Yeah. Feel free to follow us on Twitter on Dithering on the Edge at DitheringE. Goodbye for now.
And goodbye from me as well. Okay. Bye.
Bye. Right, okay, wait. It's late. Tape,
slate.
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 Okay.
Right.